For those of you wondering why we are open today, the judiciary has appropriated funds to keep running for approximately 10 days under the circumstances, including today. The first case for argument is number 13-1202, Joseph against Sassafras Ness. Mr. Lacey.
Good morning. May it please the court, Michael Lacey on behalf of the appellant, Emmanuel Joseph. The issue before the court today is whether or not Mr. Joseph, as a franchisee under the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act, failed to timely pay for gasoline invoices he receives from Sassafras Net, who is the franchisor under the terms of the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act. The time in question begins approximately July 8th, 2010, and continues to July 20th, 2010. Mr. Joseph, as a franchisee, was obligated to make available funds for the payment of his gasoline invoices via electronic funds transfer. On or about July 8th, 2010, he notified Sassafras Net that he was changing the bank accounts. Sassafras Net at that time informed him that he had not given adequate notice, that the process was already begun, and that they would continue to draft the former bank account. Consequently, the EFT was returned with insufficient funds. Joseph then paid a $2,500 penalty and made good on the invoice within 3 days after that, on the timetable provided by Sassafras Net. Subsequent to that, Sassafras Net went forward and drafted the old account again after they had knowledge of the transfer and had adequate time to draft a new account. Sassafras acknowledged that, and there was no penalty applied acknowledging their mistake. Where it becomes interesting is that in the petroleum business, if you're a branded distributor or branded retailer, you are obligated to take the retailer's credit cards. When the customer comes into the gas station and charges gasoline, the funds don't go to the retailer. They go to the franchisor. The franchisor then puts the money or transfers the money into the account of the dealer. The dealer has no choice in this matter. It is a requirement under the franchise agreement that they have to not only use their proprietary system, but they have to use a proprietary equipment, and in fact, they actually pay rent to use the equipment. In this case, Sassafras Net drafted the new bank account, but continued to put the credit cards in the old bank account. Now, the retailers need the credit card funds in Joseph's case. It's approximately $5,000 a day.
Mr. Lacey, did Sassafras Net have actual knowledge that Mr. Joseph needed the proceeds from those credit cards to pay the July 15th NSF? Were they on actual notice that they had to get those credit card receipts back to him so he could meet the bill that was due on July 15th?
Judge, I would say yes, and the reason I would say that is that the account in which the credit card receipts are placed is the same account from which the payment is drawn to pay Sassafras from the fuel.
Sassafras Net knows that?
Yes, sir. They put the credit card receipts into that account. They have total control of the credit card receipts. The credit card receipts go to Sassafras Net. Once Sassafras Net gets the credit cards, it then puts them in the respective bank account that has been provided by the retailer, or in this case, Joseph. Because these funds were not made available, the payment was returned NSF. That happened a second time. Now, the problem here is that Sassafras had no control over the receipts. Nevertheless, the district court determined that Sassafras did, in fact, have control over these credit card receipts, that it was up to Joseph, to determine and monitor SassafrasNet to make sure SassafrasNet did what they were supposed to do so Joseph's payment wouldn't be returned.
And the district court made that determination on the original record. Am I correct?
Yes, sir. I believe that's correct.
Did you ask that the record be expanded?
No, sir, I did not.
If I've got this straight, Mr. Lacey, for the third controversial payment,
yes, sir.
The SassafrasNet did transfer the credit card receipts to an account under Joseph's control, but in your view, sent it to the wrong account. Is that right?
That's correct.
It went to the old account rather than the new one, and nobody arranged to transfer the money from Joseph's old account to the new account so that it would cover the cost.
That's correct.
Okay.
So as a result of this, this happened two times. Joseph met with SassafrasNet, and the initial NFS was the 15th of July. He made arrangements on the 20th of July. He paid all the two NFS. In addition to that, he also paid for an invoice that was not yet due and payable. He has not, since that time, been in default under any payments. The court and the appellee cite cases that are really inapplicable to the case at hand. The court cites to Moody. But in the Moody case, it's true that Moody, like here, had an NSF check. But in Moody, the NFS check, there was a persistent delinquent balance. The check was not made good for over a year. There was persistent late payment. Similarly, in Hinkleman, which is relied on also by the district court. In Hinkleman, there was no rent payment made for 9 months, or at least there was a dispute over the amount due for 9 months. There was a late payment in September. There was a late payment in October. He finally paid, was told when he paid that if he did it again, his account or his franchise would be terminated, and nevertheless failed to timely pay the next time. None of that happened here. There has not been a persistent, constant delinquent debt payable to SassafrasNet. The last instance was completely out of Joseph's control.
Well, that's not obviously not the way the district court saw it, and I'm concerned, Mr. Lacey, you seem to be re-arguing the facts to us, and that's not...
Well,
is there a legal error in your view that the district judge made?
I believe that the reliance on the Moody case and the Hinkleman case is in error. That there, in each of those cases, there was a outstanding delinquent debt for an extended period of time. That's different this year.
As to which element of the case was that reliance and error?
Well, I would say the basis for the untimely payment is detailed in the Brock case, which outlines the congressional intent, which is there's a persistent arrearages in late payment. And that is why
the district judge considered a long history of payment problems that went back before July of 2010, right?
They did, but none of those are proper ground for termination under the Act.
Well, the time limit, I understand, is that what
yes,
you're talking
about? Yes, that's
what
I'm saying.
Well, there's a time limit as to what can be a ground for termination. But we remanded to the district court to consider how serious this was in light of the entire history of the relationship. The fact that it may not be grounds for termination doesn't mean that it's irrelevant or inadmissible.
Okay. And all I would say there, Judge, you're talking about two specific events over a year's period of time. As counsel argues in his brief, there was a sweeping of the accounts. Accounts were cross-collateralized. Okay. There were three NSFs then, which were remedied within 7 days, but it was because of the cross-collateralization of the account. Granted, that was within his control. I grant you that if they wanted to at that time, they may have had grounds for termination, or at least you still get into the issue as to whether or not it has been a persistent arrearage. But in any event, that was cured, and then we come 14 months later, and to prevent any more of the cross collateralization having any impact on the payment, he changes his bank account. And it's just a second incident. although it involved three different invoices over 5 days, it's really a similar incident.
Where does the persistent arrearage standard come from?
Brock, where it says persistent overages or delinquencies.
As opposed to the statutory provisions.
Well, that was the interpretation of statutory provisions. What is a failure to timely pay?
Mm-hmm. What's our standard of review here?
Well, in this case, because it was a preliminary injunction, is whether or not there was clear error on the behalf of the U.S. District Court, I believe. This was a preliminary injunction, a motion for preliminary injunction.
Does discretion come into play in deciding whether to issue an injunction?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, I believe it does. And I believe the discretion in this particular instance exceeded the boundaries. I believe that the case law provides for a persistent, constant delinquency on behalf of the franchisee. That does not exist in this case.
How much does it take?
I wouldn't know that, Judge. But the case law that is cited...
How should we write it? If we agree with that, how should we write it? Suppose all three of those failures to pay had been within Mr. Joseph's control.
I would still argue that no.
10?
I would say a long enough period of time, Judge, where there was actually a danger to Sassafras Net that it wouldn't get paid. In this case, it was paid in 5 days. And I'm just looking at the time period and the prior cases. And there is no case cited or one that I found where a party has paid within 5 days that have been found to be grounds for termination. I believe I'm out of time here, judges.
You're into your rebuttal time, so if you want to reserve the rest of your time, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Lacey. For defendant and appellee Sassafras Net, Mr. Burnett.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Tom Burnett. I represent the defendant appellee in this matter, Sassafras Net, LLC. The issue in this case is whether the district court clearly erred in determining that the two of the three NSFs in July of 2010, which formed the basis for my client's termination decision, constituted failures to make timely payment within the meaning of Section 2801.13 of the PMPA. As the court well knows, and as it instructed the district court in its earlier decision in Mr. Joseph's appeal, The question under 2801.13 is whether any of the untimely payments that Mr. Joseph made in July of 2010 were within his reasonable control and were sufficiently important to the franchise relationship. It's our position that the district court did precisely what this court instructed it to do in its decision in July of last year. It applied the facts based on its review of an extensive evidentiary record, based on subsequent briefing of the parties on remand, and ultimately the decision to deny Mr. Joseph's preliminary injunction did not constitute an abuse of discretion. With respect to the first question, whether any of those NSFs in July of 2010 were within Mr. Joseph's reasonable control, Mr. Lacey is focused here today and in his briefing as part of this appeal on the third NSF, which occurred in July of 2010. Mr. Joseph's position has been throughout this appeal that third NSF was caused, I think at least in part, by my client's depositing of credit card receipts in the wrong account. We disagree with that position, but before I explain why, I think it's important to note that there was that first NSF in July of 2010, which I don't think anybody disputes was solely caused by Mr. Joseph's error in failing to provide my client adequate advance notice of his decision to change banks. Mr. Joseph has conceded as part of this appeal that failure was within his reasonable control. And it's our position that under the per se rule adopted in the court's decision last summer, under 2802B2C, under 2802 sub C 8, that alone provides a sufficient basis for termination in this case. But because Mr. Joseph has focused primarily on that third NSF, I do think it's appropriate for us to consider the question of whether even that one was within his reasonable control. In this case, as I said, he's taken the position, as Mr. Lacey stated during his argument, they take the position that because my client deposited funds in one account versus the other, it fell outside Mr. Joseph's reasonable control. What the district court determined in this case is that when Mr. Joseph was making the decision to change banks, it was his responsibility to ensure that his new account was adequately funded, irrespective of where my client deposited credit card funds. While we acknowledge that my client deposited funds in one account versus the other, it was in a working account that Mr. Joseph had access to, had the ability to access those funds, and if he was in if he was operating as he should have been, he would have been able to transfer funds from one account to the other if the second account was not adequately funded on its own accord.
Mr. Burnett, is it correct that all of those NSF payments were correctly paid within a few days, and that since July 2010, Mr. Joseph has been current?
I do think, Your Honor, that Mr. Joseph satisfied any delinquency within not necessarily a day or two, but certainly a few days. I think that would be a fair characterization.
Your client's not actually out any money here.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I do think it's important to note that the PMPA doesn't have a requirement that any late payment be late for an extended period of time, for a day, for a week, for a month. It simply states that the late payments, and under the case law that Mr. Lacey has cited in his opening remarks, it's a repeated late payment or arrearage. It's not necessarily a persistent arrearage that requires my client to be out of money for a significant period of time. And I don't think it's hard to understand the rationale why that is. My client has 18 different dealers within his network. He's required, as the district court found, to pay for fuel from BP on the day he orders it on behalf of his clients. He gives his dealers, rather, the same terms that BP provides him. If every single one of those 18 dealers is a day late or 2 days late, my client is in a position where he's financing fuel purchases on behalf of every single one of his dealers. If you multiply that times multiple orders of fuel every month times 18 dealers, it's simply unworkable. And that's what the district court was considering in this case, I think particularly when it was turning to the second inquiry under 2801.13, whether or not the untimely payments that Mr. Joseph is responsible for within the month of July 2010 were sufficiently important to the franchise relationship to justify termination. I think the district court looked at, as the court noted, Mr. Joseph's repeated history of untimely payments over the course of barely a year. This is actually a relatively short business relationship, and Mr. Joseph was responsible for, in our opinion, 10 NSFs, which occurred during just over a year period of time. Within that first year of the party's business relationship, he had 7 payments for fuel rejected or dishonored for insufficient funds. That's a payment record that is unlike any record of any other dealer. My client testified at the hearing that the district court held that of his 18 dealers, Mr. Joseph is the only one who has a single NSF. I think that goes to show why it is that this is an important obligation that the dealers embrace themselves, why most dealers, other than Mr. Joseph, are careful to make sure that their payments are received timely by my client, and why his failure to make those timely payments is sufficiently important to the franchise relationship. In this case, the district court made those determinations. Mr. Lacey has argued that because the payments are a day late or 2 days late and are ultimately satisfied, there's no importance in that case. I think that ignores the district court's findings on the significant impact it has on my client's relationships, not only with Mr. Joseph, but on the relationships it has with the other dealers within its network. It makes it impossible to manage its affairs. It makes it difficult to ensure that my client's business operations are running smoothly. I do think it's important to note that the district court concluded that both of the NSFs, the first and the third, which occurred in July of 2010, were within Mr. Joseph's reasonable control. Each one of those was sufficiently important to the franchise relationship for the reasons I've already stated here today. And as a result, the termination decision was appropriate.
Mr. Burnett, is your client's relationship with BP covered by the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't think it is. The relationship between my client and the individual dealers, I think the PMPA is intended to protect individual franchisees. My client under the PMPA is considered a franchisor. The relationship between him and each of the 18 franchisees within his network, I do think is regulated by the PMPA.
That's clearly correct. Since the franchise, I haven't sorted all this out. I'm just wondering, the statute does allow for a franchise to refer to a contract between a refiner and a distributor if other criteria met. I just was wondering if you'd thought that through.
And I haven't, Your Honor. It may well be that it is regulated by the PMPA. I do think it's important to note that the PMPA was intended, as we stated in our briefs, to protect individual franchisees like Mr. Joseph from arbitrary or discriminatory terminations. The initial intent behind the PMPA was to protect franchisees from underhanded efforts by franchisors to try to strong-arm franchisees into complying with their marketing techniques that may or may not have been appropriate. That was ultimately the intent behind the PMPA. It wasn't intent to undercut my client's opportunities to make legitimate business decisions. In this case, it wasn't intended to preclude my client from making an appropriate decision after a period of time. I do think it's important to note that my client did precisely what the PMPA envisioned. It didn't rush to terminate upon the occurrence of a single late payment. It tried to work with Mr. Joseph over the course of a relatively young business relationship to try to bring him into compliance. After it proved that they were unable to do that, after it proved that Mr. Joseph's repeated untimely payments were sufficiently harmful to my client's business relationship, after it appeared that it just wasn't going to be possible to bring him into compliance, only then did my client opt to terminate Mr. Joseph. I think the district court's conclusions are well supported by the facts in this case. I think the court applied the standards under 2801.13 consistent with this court's opinion from last summer, as well as the opinions of other federal courts throughout the country applying the PMPA. And for that reason, we don't think it's decision to deny the preliminary injunction was an abuse of discretion. So unless the court has any additional questions, I will stand on our briefs and take a seat.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Boyce, you have a few minutes in rebuttal.
Mr. Lacey, your brother has spent a great deal of time talking about the events prior to the July NSFs and says his client had every right to take those into consideration in determining the appropriateness of a termination. You haven't spoken much about the events prior to July of year. Can we have your views on that?
Well, we're talking about primarily June of 2009. There were a series of three or four NSF. As the appellee states in its brief, Manuel Joseph owned 10 gas stations. And to finance the acquisition and get working capital, he had cross-collateralized them. He also had another business. He had an obligation come due that he and the bank swept all his accounts. And as a result of that, the fuel invoices for those three invoices, they were rapid succession. It was 1-2 right in a row. And Mr. Joseph, when he was made aware of that, immediately within 3 days, paid for all of those invoices. Subsequent to that, we come to July 2010. I believe there were, if I'm correct, there were two other invoices that were a day late in, I want to say, March 2010. Which were immediately rectified. And I understand his concern. But if he had real concerns, Mr. Joseph does business with Sassafrasnet at two locations. Because of this cross-collateralization issue, a similar issue happened at the other one. I mean, the purpose of the timely payment is to protect the franchisor in this instance from being stuck with a bad client who isn't going to pay his bill. That's not the case here. If that were the case, he would not have only terminated the franchise relationship at Lawrence and Marine, but he would have terminated the other franchise relationship where he sells a significantly larger volume of gasoline. Yet he continues to do business with them at that location. We don't believe, based on the case law, and the fact situation in the existing case law, that this particular fact situation warrants termination. Nor do we feel that Sassafrasnet honestly believes it was ever in jeopardy. If it did, it would not continue to do business with Mr. Joseph at the other location.
Looks as if Joseph was undercapitalized.
Pardon me?
I say Joseph was undercapitalized. Is that what it boils down to?
No, it wasn't undercapitalized, Judge. The economy changed.
He's in all these businesses, and he just didn't have enough capital to go around.
No, he just had to reorganize the capital. I mean, he's fine now. He hasn't had a late payment in the last 2 years. But the problem was when the economy shifted, what was a working situation with the banks no longer was, and he had to reorganize it, and he hasn't had a problem since. He's already had the assets. He had a temporary problem allocating the assets as the economy shifted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lacy. The case is taken under advisement.